Hey everybody, it's Carol Tice
It's
here with
Carol
Linda
Tice here
Formicelli.
with Linda Formicelli.
Hey everyone.
Huh, I'm getting an echo on
I'm
your
getting
end
an
now,
echo
Linda.
on your end now, Linda.
Which of course
Great.
was
All right, let
fine
me mute myself
before
for now.
yeah, it was fine before we
Yeah, it was
officially
fine
started
before we
the
officially
call.
started the call.
Okay.
Not sure what is causing that, but and now I don't see where Linda is. Oh, now I see you. Okay, you
I
muted
see you.
yourself.
Okay, you
Yeah,
muted
I'm just
yourself.
muting myself. Does it sound any better now, or?
Not if I talk and
Not if I
you're
talk and you're
on. I'm getting
on.
another
I'm
one of
getting
me,
another
so
one of me.
we'll have to
So
have you
we'll have
mute
to have
when
you
you're not
mute
talking.
when you're not talking.
Okay.
Which you sounded like you wanted to do anyway, since you're coughing. So, anyway, we did a little pre-show here, but it's Carol Tice here, the Den Mother, with Linda Formicelli.
Shelly.
Hello.
And this is our right big support call number two. We're here to answer questions, and we've already got bunches of tasty ones. And right in the pre-show, I think Lori, or was it Lisa, was saying that she is worried about pitching to magazines. Yeah, Lisa said she's worried about pitching to bigger magazines and what types of articles to pitch, and that all the ideas are already taken. So I have a post I'm popping in a chat about the fact that all the stories are never already taken. That no matter how many times a story has been done, it can be done again. Not a problem. So you just have to find another angle and another market for it where it hasn't yet been covered. And I have one other post I want to give you, which is how to be that writer with a million story ideas. So let me throw that in. Linda used to have a bunch of awesome links, but her blog is gone. But luckily, mine lives on. This is another one about anytime people tell me, oh, it feels like all the ideas have already been taken and... you know, it's so hard to come up with a new idea. I just know you're not reading widely enough. But this post has a couple of ideas. Anyway, did you want to take Brigitte's question up top,
question
Linda?
Up top, Linda?
Yeah. Do I sound okay? Can you hear me all right now?
Yeah, you're good.
Yeah, you're good.
Okay, good. So Brigitte says, here are some questions for tomorrow's call. Okay. When submitting requested clips for a magazine, should the clips be specific to the magazine type, or show a variety of writing topics and styles? And I think it depends on where you're at in your career and what you have, because Carol and I always say you have to use what you have. So when you're first starting out, you might have something that's not exactly relevant to the publication you want to pitch, but you send it anyway. Eventually, when you start developing one or more niches and get more clips, then you can worry about sending the most relevant clips to the most relevant publications. So you'd send your health clips to Fitness Magazine and your women's clips to Redbook and so on. That would be the ideal. But until then, when you can't do it, don't worry about it. You just want to be showing the editor that you understand the publication process, you have gone through the editorial process, you know how to write, and so on. And any clip will really show that. Did you want to add anything, Carol, or should I go on to the next one?
Go ahead.
Okay. Is it acceptable to just give a link to my website referring to clips instead of attaching clips? Yes, we usually recommend that people don't attach clips or anything to an email that an editor didn't ask for. So if you are pitching for the first time and they have not requested your clips, you could always offer a link to your portfolio page on your website or links to particular articles you might have that are online. You could also say, I've written for X, Y, and Z. Let me know if you'd like me to send you some samples. And actually, Diana Burrell and I are redoing the Renegade Writer book, and one of the rules we're breaking, Carol's going to hate us, is to never send an unwanted attachment, and we actually have a very good story from a writer who thought a photo that she took was really going to sell this idea, and she attached it, and she sold it. And these days, we have such good virus protection. You know, editors know not to download links that, you know, are clearly obviously phishing or spam. So you know, if you really want or need to attach something, it's probably not a big deal. But in terms of clips, especially big ones or when you have lots of them, I would say either a link or just mention that you have them at first. And then it says, is a website now my resume or do I still submit my resume if asked? It's so funny because I've been writing for magazines for 20 years and I don't think anybody has ever, ever, ever asked for my resume. Sometimes you'll go on job boards where somebody's looking for a writer and they'll ask for a resume in which case if you're doing that, it might help to have one handy, but it's not happened to me. If for some reason an editor or a client, a potential client does ask for a resume, I would just send them one and just whip it up pretty quickly. It doesn't have to be anything fancy. I'm not sure if a website would work unless you have your resume or CV up as a tab on your website. Otherwise, they're kind of having to go through your About Me page and your What I Do page and everything else and figure out who you are as opposed to having that one page snapshot of you. I love this question from Brigitte. When magazines firmly ask not to contact editors and instead use their submittable program only, do I still override the request? Yeah, that's one of those go with your gut things. If I were looking at a website and it said do not contact the editors individually, use this form, I would do that. But if you're looking at guidelines that look like they haven't been updated in 10 years and they say submit to submissions at magazine.com, I usually ignore those. So. Another question. You have a lot of questions. These are good. For children's magazines such as Cricut Publishing, they ask for complete manuscripts. Do you recommend this when submitting research articles? Oh, okay, so that's another question. Do you recommend this? That is a very difficult one. It depends on how much you want to be in that magazine and how many clips you already have. My editor at Writer's Digest once talked about what he calls an on-spec query, where if you are a new writer, the editor is taking a big risk in hiring you. They don't know you. You write the article, and then in your query you say, you talk about your article, and you say, and I've already written it. Let me know if you'd like to see it. And that way you're not sending it without them asking, and also it kind of takes the risk off of them that they will hire you and you won't be able to do the job. So in this case, if you are a new writer, you don't have a lot of clips, you really want to do this, then go ahead. The only problem being if you are writing an article specifically for a publication and they turn it down, there's really not many places you're going to be able to sell that again. So it could be a waste of time on your part. So you really need to balance that out. And let's see, when submitting researched articles, do I attach works cited? Yes, so I, for example, when I wrote for Health Magazine, they were very heavy into research, obviously. I would have, I would annotate the article, and I would have footnotes with each source for every fact and every quote in the article, and if there was anything that was not, for example, from an interview where I would just send them the person's phone number for fact-checking, I would attach it. So if it were a diet piece, I would go to the USDA database and parse out all the calories and download those as PDFs and attach those. You can scan book pages and highlight the parts you use and send those. But in many, many cases these days, you're just going to be sending them links to various websites where you found things like PubMed or whatever. So that's a really good question. And yes, you would reference them in the article, as you asked. And then the letter of introduction link, Carol put in the chat. So is there anything else on that, Carol? Do you have anything to add? Or?
No, I think you got it.
Okay.
I never.
If you can mute. I don't know what we can do. No problem. I always just send out links because... my experience when I was a staff writer was that anything if you sent an email with an attachment to an editor you did not already personally know and have a relationship with, they just delete it immediately. There are just too many risks to them with viruses that could take down their production, that they do on those computers. You just don't really want to be attaching anything. If you're turning in an assignment, you know, and they're expecting it, great. But otherwise, you don't want to be sending attachments to them. So some great questions have been coming in, but why don't we go in order of the and catch these ones that we got. that we got on Facebook ahead of time. I wanted to get to Deb's comment that she was still struggling with negative thoughts, especially when I get tired and overwhelmed with working part-time and raising children. It's been quite a juggle during this month. And, you know, I kind of feel you on that because for a long time, I had a full-time job and young toddler adopted special needs children, and I was building my blog. So, yeah, it's really, really hard and takes a lot of time. I went through about 2.5 years where, you know, I didn't go out to dinner. I didn't go to plays. I didn't go to movies. I didn't go out and see my friends and stuff. I just built my business. And not that you have to make that life choice in particular, but something has to give somewhere in the equation if you want to build this side business to where you can quit the part-time job and all. And, you know, just to brainstorm a few ideas of puzzle pieces that might be moved around is, could your husband do more childcare on a weekend day and maybe you could do freelance marketing then? You know, are there other ways to get more childcare help, babysitting co-op, relatives, you know, church volunteers, and or looking at what you can outsource or streamline, you know, errand running, cooking, you know, there's all those meal delivery services now where you don't have to do any food prep that are, you know, all in startup mode and offering you free meals to try them out. And, you know, think creatively about your schedule and how you could get more productive blocks of work time. And the other side of this is to just kind of realize that if you have young kids and a part-time job and you're trying to launch a freelance business, that this will probably take longer than you would dream in the ideal that it would take. And I recommend just kind of being okay with that. Just sort of forgive yourself that, you know, you don't have nothing but time to build your freelance writing business and be okay with going at the pace you're able to go at, you know. And the other thing that I guess Brigitte said was, I have thoughts like, is it too late for me? Yeah, no. If you're breathing, it's not too late for you. I mean, Linda and I have coached writers in their 70s, in their 80s. And if you have young kids, I'm going to assume you're younger than that, you know? So, you know, yeah, it's going to be tiring and you need to also continue doing self-care and sleeping well and eating well and, you know, doing all the stuff that makes this sustainable. So, you know, go at the speed you need to go, but do look at efficiency that you can create, I'd say. So, you wanted to talk about this, where will I find the time to do the marketing and sleep? Before Linda has a whole big thing from an article she's doing that she wants to do. But before we do that, I just want to say that, you know, I coach a lot of people in Dentoex Income Accelerator about this because they're people who have established freelance businesses and they're working hard in them, but now they need to do a whole bunch of new marketing to get better clients or get, you know, raises or, and they're like, how can I do that? Because I'm busy working my freelance client work. And my tip with that is always micro marketing tips. You know, think about one tiny marketing activity you could get done all day. You know, a lot of times when I was super busy with freelance work, I would just go on LinkedIn and look at who's viewed my profile and send quick emails to anyone who looked like a prospect who had looked at my profile. And like that would take me 5 minutes a morning. But just see if you can get a tiny bit of marketing like that into every day. You make one phone call, send one letter of introduction, you know, look up 5 prospects' emails, and that's all for the day. But it just moves you forward a tiny bit. So that was my tip. And Linda has another tip.
Yep, just takes me a second to unmute. Yes, so I'm actually working on an article that is going to be going up on my website and on the iTunes podcast on Thursday about the best type of schedule for a writer. And I outlined different types of schedules. And the one I think really fits here is called the day job juggle. And I can read this. It's only a couple of paragraphs, and I think it will be helpful. If you're trying to build a freelance career around your 9-to-5 job, you may have no choice but to use the spare minutes of your day to get your writing-related work done. This also applies if you're a stay-at-home parent who is with your kids all day. So this is actually what Carol was just talking about. Many of us don't even notice the chunks of 10, 20, and 30 minutes that often pop up during the day, which we typically waste by surfing Facebook or running off to grab a coffee. The trick with the day job juggle schedule is to create a big list of everything that needs to be done. You can go even further and divide the list up according to how long you estimate each task will take, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30, 45, an hour. Any tasks on your plate that are too long, you could chunk down into more manageable bites that will fit into those. For example, instead of trying to jam building your writer website into a small block of time, divide it into writing your About Me page and then writing your Hire Me page, sourcing photos, brainstorming your tagline, gathering testimonial, working on your design, and so on. Hey, look, my microphone just arrived in the mail. Carry with you everything you need to get work done in those odd windows of open time. Maybe you can dictate part of an article into your phone, which is what I did with this article. Make a few cold calls from your cell phone during your lunch hour and work on your website in the evening when your kids are taking their bath. Listen to business development podcasts in your car or on the bus or train on the way to and from work. Bring your laptop or tablet with you everywhere you go so you can pop it open and get some work done wherever you are. The downside to the day job juggle, and this is also something Carol was just talking about earlier, is that if you fill every second of the day with work for a long period of time, you can experience burnout. Make sure you still have time to yourself to take a nice shower, read a book, or see the occasional movie. If you're building a freelance career around a day job or kids, your progress will necessarily be slower than if you were able to work full-time on your freelancing. Don't run yourself into the ground and don't get yourself down about your slower progress. It's normal and to be expected. So that is actually going up on Thursday, but I thought that was pretty relevant to what we were talking about. And you know what? Before Carol gets on, I should also mention, I probably mentioned this a lot, the book 168 Hours, You Have More Time Than You Think by Laura Vanderkam. And she is very, very good at convincing the reader that they actually do have time to do all the things they want to do, but they need to think more creatively about their schedule. So I really highly recommend that book.
Yeah, true enough. And you know, I had a guest post from a woman who was a single mom of three who found like 40 more work hours or something in her week. I'll look that up for you. Because it was really... She really, really did a great job of looking at every aspect of how she spent her time, and she found a lot of free time and really ramped up her business as a result. So we got through that tip. Well, I have Alyssa's up at the top, but I have like three, four others. Why don't we go to, I want to take them in order. Lisa said she was a long-time she's a long-time writer, but she's always worried about pitching to bigger magazines and what types of articles to pitch and that the ideas are all taken. She prefers to get writing assignments. So before I let Linda give some tips about pitching bigger magazines, which Linda has done a ton of, I just want to say that we hear that a lot from writers that I just want to get editors to just give me a bunch of assignments and because I'm really not good at developing ideas. So I what I want is to just kind of sit here and wait for the assignments to flow in. And I just want to say that you want to get out of that mentality because it mostly doesn't exist anymore. The world where there was a big editorial staff and they thought up all the ideas and then they just took their go-to writers and parceled out the assignments to them, there just isn't a lot of that left anymore. Those big editorial staffs are gone. And the few editors that have survived are deeply into having you bring them the ideas. Your value to them is your idea. So I just want to, you know, recommend that you commit yourself to being a writer who develops a lot of story ideas and has a lot of story ideas up their sleeve, because story ideas are the coin of the realm these days. They're what get you assignments. And Linda, I'm going to let you riff on this whole what type of articles to pitch.
I also wanted to mention, though, that for people who do really, really hate doing those big, long pitches, trade magazines are a very good option because that is one type of magazine where the editors tend to know a lot more about the industry than you do, and they generate ideas in houses and look to freelance them out. And that doesn't always happen. I mean, I've pitched trade magazines and gotten assignments accepted, But I've also had trade magazine editors come to me with ideas. And if you break into a trade, perhaps by showing them that you have some good ideas and that you have something to offer instead of just, hey, here I am, often you will become part of their stable of writers and they will be farming stuff out to you on a regular basis, which is a really nice way to make regular, more reliable income than pitching those giant magazines that take 9 months to get paid. In terms of talking about not being able to find ideas and they've all been done, it's funny because Carol says they haven't all been done, but my take on it is that they have all been done. But the secret is you need to find a slant on it that hasn't been done, at least recently. What do you bring to the table that other writers are not pitching? For example, a lot of health writers will be looking at the same press releases and they'll write to an editor at, say, Women's Health Magazine and say, hey, here's this press release on this new vitamin they just discovered. Would you like me to write on it? And the thing is, the editor got that press release. Every other writer got that press release, and they're not really offering anything that the editor can't do themselves. So in this example, which is true for all ideas, you need to figure out how can I make this a more interesting, saleable idea that the editor hasn't seen before. So if it's about a new vitamin L, that nobody has found before, it could be new discoveries in vitamins or the five top ailments that are caused by a lack of vitamin L, or, you know, there are just so many ways that you could go with it. And it also depends on your market because, okay, fitness magazine, health magazine, women's magazine, women's health, they've heard of vitamin L. But what about, for example, a magazine for parents of kids with ADHD? Because you read in that press release that vitamin L is good for kids with ADHD. You can also look for markets where this wouldn't be such an obvious idea. So there are lots and lots of ways of taking what seems like an old idea that's already been done and slanting it in a way that only you could be the writer of this piece. So I hope that makes sense. I know that was a lot of information. Carol?
Yeah, just to give you an example, one of my favorite ways to flip a story is to either localize a national story or nationalize a local story.
Mm-hmm.
So you see something going on in your market. A lot of grilled cheese sandwich restaurants are opening up in Seattle. And I'm like, huh, that's interesting. Maybe I've written about that for the Puget Sound Business Journal here in Seattle. But maybe if I look around the country, I see, oh, hey, this is not the only place this is happening. There's a half a dozen chains. And they're in multiple locations. So this could also be a national story. And then I write that story for Forbes or the Puget Sound Business Journal, for Nation's Restaurant News, a restaurant trade about, you know, so that's a trend I'm reporting in restaurant. So that's a simple way to take a story that's maybe already been done, possibly even done by you, and redoing it in a completely different lens for a different audience. So that's always the question I ask myself when I see an idea. It's like, man, I'd really like to get on this idea, write something about it too. And then you start thinking, well, who will need more in-depth information about this or a new spin on this or fresh data on this? Or who could I write this story for on the one-year anniversary of this where I would pitch them, you know, 6 months ahead of that and be the first person in the door with that angle? And I've meanwhile lined up interviews with the people who were affected by that tragedy, and I'm going to get that assignment. So thinking ahead about anniversary dates is also another big method. But let's continue because we have some stuff. So Rich was asking some basic break-in questions, how to find online paying markets, and what types of writing pay. Just want to say in general, not short stories, your novel and personal essays so much, and nonfiction reported articles, you know, journalistic articles for magazines and copywriting and business writing are the bulk of the paying work for anyone who did not know sort of the lay of the marketplace. So do you want to take Lori's question about how much research you do before you pitch to magazines? Mm-hmm. Linda.
Oh, can you hear me now? Sorry about that. Lori says, I know before pitching to magazines, we need to research their past issues to make sure they have not already published a similar topic. However, the time to read and research all that is one thing that keeps me stuck and eats a lot of time. Yeah, there's a whole lot of kind of over-research and over-analysis that goes into developing a pitch for a lot of people. I think that with so many publications having their archives online, you could very easily go on there and type in some key terms and see if they have done it any time in the recent past. I don't know anybody these days who gets six hard copies of the magazine and reads them from end to end to see what they have already done. Also, there is a question below that's going to tie into this from Alyssa, where a lot of people are assuming you're going to be pitching just one magazine. And this ties into somebody else's question too. A lot of publications, if they are not interested, do not get back to you. And there are also a lot of publications that take forever to get back to you. And although simultaneous querying is frowned upon by editors, we have to make a living. So that is just something we have to do. Therefore, if you are pitching an idea, it makes the most sense to pitch an idea where you can find at least a handful of potential markets for it. Because it really, really stinks if you write this one pitch that is only going to work in this one publication and they turn it down. I mean, we have to remember we're business people and we do have to be somewhat efficient about it. So if you are pitching an idea and you are looking for multiple markets to send it to, if you can do a quick search on their archives or a quick look anywhere else and determine that it doesn't look like they've done anything like that, then go ahead and pitch it because we're presupposing here that you're pitching to a bunch of places anyway. So if something looks halfway reasonable, you might as well pitch it. It's not going to take you any extra time. That was going to lead into something else. You're doing simultaneous submissions. You're pitching it to a bunch of places at one time. Oh, also, if you are pitching something that isn't even a reasonable fit for a publication, I have to say you're probably ahead of 90% of the writers out there. So don't overthink it. Don't overanalyze it. And we have to remember that a lot of times an editor will reject your idea, but ask you to pitch more or invite you to write something else. And I actually, this is a part of the new Renegade Writer book that we're working on where we talked to editors and we found several of them who said, yes, I would reject something and sometimes I would give them something else because I could see from their pitch that even though it wasn't an exact hit, this was good for us. This would be a good writer for us. So we have to start looking at queries not just as my one shot to get an assignment from this one publication, but this is the way I'm trying to open the door to a relationship at a bunch of publications at the same time. Because again, a lot of times you're going to get rejected, but if they say pitch again, that is the beginning of a relationship, and that's where work comes from, is building a relationship over time with an editor through pitching or through sending them updates on what you're doing, but you have to get that door open first. So it's a lot less pressure to look at your pitch as a way to get your foot in the door somewhere that looks reasonable and not like your one and only shot at this one thing. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, I think that's a really good approach. And I can tell you many times I have sent in, I like multi-pitch, so I'm often sending two or three really brief pitch ideas, especially if it's a trade pub or something like that. And very often they'll say, yeah, no to those, but yeah, we should totally work together. We have this special section coming up about this, and we need story ideas about this arcane topic. Could you develop some and, pitch us some for that? Or, we need someone to write this story about the data that we created, for this package, and we need someone to write that, lead story that unpacks the data. Well, I'm a complete data whore, so I love database stories. So I'm like, me. Yeah, it is a relationship starter. I'll just say anytime I pitch three ideas for a trade pub and it's like three quick bullets, usually the third one is one that I just kind of threw in because I think three is better than two. And it's always, in my mind, the weakest idea. And that's almost always the one they assign if they take one of the three. So, you know, like Linda said, it's hard to read minds about what editors might be wanting. And the main thing, yeah, is to think of that query letter or that letter of introduction as a writing audition. And if you pass that audition, you can build a relationship even if they didn't like that particular idea. So hopefully that's comforting. I need to take Alyssa's question about, have you found that your pitches get absolutely no answer at all, or is it more often the case that they will send you an actual rejection? Alyssa, if you go back about 20 years, you used to get a letter back that said, sorry, this isn't for us, you know, best of luck. And that just mostly never happens anymore. You're just going to hear from people if they're interested. But her follow-up question is, I wonder how long to wait before giving up on an idea and moving on. My answer is 0 minutes, because I don't do any waiting in my marketing process whatsoever. I move on immediately and continue pitching. But she says, how long to wait before giving up on an idea? If you think you have a great idea and it's not becoming dated and you think it st could still be done, never give up on your idea. Just find more places to pitch it. And this kind of gets to what Linda was saying about coming up with ideas that you feel there are more than one market for. It's just a more efficient way to earn a living. So she says, I pitched a magazine last week and I haven't heard anything. Yeah, you and every other writer in America. The thing to know is, like, especially if it's a monthly magazine, there's sort of a cycle to those editors' lives where there's a couple weeks of the cycle where they are not looking at new pitches. All they are doing is cranking out the magazine. Like, you're not going to hear back from them. They're just putting all those pitches into a folder and they're going to take them out when they've put that issue to bed and start looking through them all. So, you know, that's why they all used to say allow 4 to 6 weeks for a response. But you can't really earn a living waiting 6 weeks to find out if someone's doing an article. So you got to just keep moving on. I'm all be a writer, not a waiter. You can also follow up in a couple of weeks and say, hey, just wanted to make sure you got it. I know Linda has done that. And I know people who say they get a lot of gigs on that reminder and people go, oh, it was in spam. And I prefer to just crank out more marketing. So that's how I roll. I find that the emotional dynamic of waiting and wondering, oh, did they like my idea? Did they not like it? I'm going to be really sad if they don't. I really love this idea. This is not a positive, fear-busting mindset. This is a negative, self-doubting mindset. So I try and stay away from that. Linda, I don't know if you have anything on that.
No, I think we covered it in, at many different angles, coming from many different perspectives. So I hope it was helpful.
Yeah, so
Still there?
Rich had asked about first steps, and I put in a link to my step-by-step guide ebook. If you really have not done any freelance writing yet and are wondering sort of where's a good place to start besides getting on a content mill, which really is a bad place to start because the kind of work you'll do on there doesn't really build your portfolio very well a lot of the time. But if you look at the step-by-step guide, it goes through all of my ways to quickly get some first clips and start pitching for real money. And he had asked about what blogs and web pages he could write articles for pay. And I posted a link to my most recent list of 92 different websites that pay at least $50 an article. So, and I did a recent update and linked to that also. And he said, would you recommend writing articles about general topics? I'm so glad you brought that up because really there's so little money in writing about general topics and being a generalist. And any website you go to that says, get paid for writing whatever you want, leave immediately because there is no business model that pays writers well that is like that. All of the good money in writing for clients is in scenarios where you're going to need to write the thing they need written. They need an article about robotics. They need a white paper about, you know, their software as a service space and trends in their sector, they're going to have something they need written, you know, or the magazine is for an audience of, you know, whoever, entrepreneurs, accountants, you know, and they're going to need articles written that help their audience. You're writing in service of their client, their reader. That's sort of the orientation where you get a lot of money. And so Lori had a question about my Freelance Writer's Den Bootcamp, which is move up to ghostwriting books. And she wondered whether it's a good fit for her and if there is still time to join. There is definitely still time to join through Wednesday night. It is not too late to join. The first recording is up, but our first Q&A is not until Thursday morning. So you have time to do that. And whether it's for you, I don't know. It's there's kind of two aspects to this bootcamp. One is that it teaches some skills that will help you with any type of writing, which is like structuring a long piece and learning how to categorize a book, which can help you if you're writing a book of your own, and line editing for tone and clarity. And that's a exercise that will help anybody. And then just how to ghostwrite on behalf of a client, you know, which is something you could apply to writing articles, blog posts, you know, other forms of content as well. You know, if you're someone who likes long form projects, I can tell you I know some pretty beginner freelance writers who have already gotten a client who turns out to want a memoir ghosted. So I don't know, you know, only you can say whether that's for you, but it is the only way to get in Freelance Writer's Den and access all our other 300 hours of things at this time. So Alyssa says, do you recommend starting an LLC or other business entity? A friend suggested she gets more business after she did that as she had a tax ID to lend and that she appeared more professional. And here in my state, it's several hundred dollars a year to keep an LLC in force. Do you think this is a good idea for a new writer? Well, there's sort of two parts to that. One is you can get a tax ID number without being an LLC, I believe. You can have an EIN. And what you should do for sure is register your business with your state and get a UBI number and be an official business, even if that business is like Alyssa Lemon Inc., you know, or Alyssa Lemon Freelance Writer, or it doesn't have to be an LLC form, but you could be a sole proprietor and register your business and get a federal tax ID number.
Yeah, can I mention?
That is good, and it's good if you want to do government contracting to have a federal tax ID number. And those are free, and you get them on the IRS's website, and it takes like 1 minute. As far as forming an LLC, the reason for forming an LLC or a S corporation is to create a layer of legal protection between your personal assets and your freelance writing business. And I was a sole proprietor for many, many, many years, and now I'm an LLC. And the reason I became one was because I wrote a print book for a traditional print publisher. And as we were getting it ready for publication, it gradually became clear to me that they were not going to have a legal department fact check my book at all. And I had to rely on a lot of sort of secondhand sources of information from companies that wouldn't talk to me and stuff. And I felt like there was real exposure there that was going to potentially come back on me personally, because you end up indemnifying them for what you're putting in the book. And that's when I became an LLC, because I had a concern about that. But in general, if you don't lie or make stuff up, and you tell the truth and disclose any conflicts of interest you ever have, you're going to be fine and not get sued. And it shouldn't really be a big worry in your life. And, you know, you could kind of get your business rolling as a sole proprietor and convert later. I totally did that. Linda, were you trying to add something there?
Yeah, no, you already said it afterwards. I was just going to say you can get an EIN in like 5 seconds.
Yeah, totally. I think we're current on questions. Let me look around. What this means if we is if we don't get new questions. Oh, I know what we know. I found a couple that we haven't done. Judy isn't on the call as far as I saw, and I'm sad because she said something that she noticed something in the class that looks like a sales funnel. And can you describe how this marketing technique can help writers get more clients? We don't know what she was looking at that she said looked like a sales funnel. I have a guess at that she may have maybe seen a writer's website where they have a free product about, copywriting best practices, and it's like a lead magnet to get prospect names on an email list. And then, you send them a newsletter every month to keep your name in front of them. I do know writers who do that. And I have to say, it seems like it works best in these sort of hardcore direct response copywriting or, very hard sell kind of environment. It seems like that may work, especially if you have a particular industry niche and you can really target who you want. In general, I think I've seen more success with writers just proactively marketing to the prospects they want to land than getting people onto email lists. I guess I think a lot of people get a lot of email these days, and it's increasingly harder to get people to go for that, especially if you don't have an amazing opt-in, bait item. So I don't know if you have any other thoughts on that, Linda.
No, I think you covered it.
Okay.
But you know what? We missed Heidi's question, and I wanted to answer it.
Okay, well, hang on, because Judy's had a sort of a part two,
Oh, sorry.
or actually, it has two more parts, and then we'll get to that.
Righty.
So she talked about how, she's got some clients and she's pitching them ideas and getting more assignments, and she's doing her client work. And she said, "How do I fit prospecting for new clients into a schedule like that?" I guess we hit that with our micro marketing and with the stuff that Linda read from her post. But her other thing was this website stuff. That's like climbing a mountain. How do you get started? I'm glad you asked that because I strongly recommend outsourcing that process and not learning all about how to be a webmaster. It's not our core competency, and there's no obligation. It's not a skill you'll use a lot. Sort of once your site is up, it's up. But I have a couple providers that I recommend, and they are Writer's Residence and Outstanding Setup, and you can read all about them on this link that I put in chat. They're on my Products I Love page. I think Writer's Residence is like $9 a month, and they give you a completely templated, ready-to-go website. They have portfolio tools where your clips look really great, and I always like to challenge people to just get your website up in a week. Do not spend a year, pulling your hair out, trying to learn HTML. No, just solve it. And if one of those solutions doesn't sound like a good thing for you, go to your local community college, find a digital design student. The professor can probably tell you who the bright bulbs are in their website design class, and get a teen, pay them a pittance. That's how I got my original writer website up, was with a friend of my son's. And so do you want to take Heidi's, and then I want to get to this thing that Lori said.
So Heidi said, how do you break up with somebody, I mean, who you've asked for more money but refuses? I think looking at this question, I'm assuming that this is somebody you have worked with in the past and you asked for a raise and they didn't give it to you. So yes, you need to decide whether or not it's worth it for you to continue writing for them, because there have been times where I asked for raises and they can't give it to me, and I'm like, oh, well, thanks for trying. I'll keep writing for you. But then there are some times where you just really, really need more money, in which case you might decide that you no longer want to work with them. And there are several ways you could go about it. One is that when they come to you next with an assignment, you're busy. Another one is, I'm sorry I can no longer work with you at that price, but let me know if you ever raise your prices in the future, which is a very gracious way of doing it, and maybe they will raise their prices. And then a third way is, if you know any writers who are willing to work for that rate, you can say, I'm afraid I can no longer work at that rate, but I know somebody who would be very happy to do it. She's a great writer, and so on. I did this way back when I was first starting out my writing career, And I was writing for a lot of trade magazines that paid, like, you know, 15, 20 cents a word, and I wanted to move up. My husband was just entering the business, and I told all these editors, I can't write for this price anymore, but my husband would be very willing to. He's, you know, he's a great writer and so on. And he ended up writing for some of those same magazines that I did until he was then able to move up to higher pay. So that is also a very nice way of getting out of it. Oh, I see Heidi put up the situation. Is this the situation? Oh, he's been a long-term client, and I asked him about raising the prices, especially going from hourly to project, and he said no, maybe in 12 months. So I basically would like to cut it off at this point. I provided a lot of copy for him and marketing services, but I need to move on. We have a good relationship, but I can see this will probably not go anywhere from here. So that might want to, you know, he sounds like a nice client, so that might be a situation where you want to recommend a friend who is kind of coming up the ladder behind you who may want to work with him. But it's very strange that he won't let you, if, especially if this is content or copywriting, that he won't let you give a project rate, because the last thing you want is somebody micromanaging your hours as if he's paying for hours and not experience and skill and the value you bring. So that's my little rant right there. I hope that helped.
Yeah, I mean, one of my primary rules of asking for a raise is if you're asking for a raise, you have to be prepared to walk if they say no, because otherwise you're their doormat. Now they know, ah, you're totally desperate. You need this rate. I said I wouldn't give it to you, and you stayed, and now I'm never giving you a raise because I know you're a weakling, and you don't really, you know, need to, you don't stand up and advocate for what you need, and I can just keep exploiting you. And yeah, you're caught in a trap.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me? There have been cases in the past where I'm writing for consumer magazines and I'm getting a pretty high rate. And I say, I was wondering if you could give me a bump up in rate. You really seem to like my work, and so do the readers. Do you think you could go to bat for me with your boss? And they'll go to bat, and they'll come back, and they cannot give me a raise, or they cannot give me the raise I wanted. And to me, it's just like, well, it was worth a try. I still am getting a good rate. I still like writing for this publication. I don't feel at all like a doormat. And they usually, you know, they usually do their best to try to get me that raise. So
yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, that's a different scenario where you're just kind of, you have a good relationship, you're making good money, but you just want to test the waters because, hey, if you're in business, that's what you should do. You should find out after you've built the relationship if there is any upscale to this, you know, and if you never ask, you may be leaving money on the table. But I think most of the people asking today are probably in scenarios where it's just, we're talking super low rates that they just don't want to work at anymore. And that is, you know, not a good thing. So Alyssa had a question about, I forget when this came up, but we were talking about how I got into writing about insurance just because my dad had sold insurance and I like knew, you know, two things about insurance, and that was two things more than most writers, and people were thrilled to have me, and, you know, I basically learned the rest of it on the job, but I had sent her a link to an article I did about tow truck fraud. I can't remember if I came up with that idea or if it was assigned, honestly, but I certainly was trolling for ideas. She says, I'm lost on how to come up with ideas about insurance that aren't redundant. You have to become a string collector. When I was writing my Forbes blog on entrepreneurship and startups, the notes file when I left to myself of ideas that could potentially become posts was like 50 pages long of just links I had seen of interesting things that I was looking for ways to connect to other things to suss out a trend, you know, to find a newsworthy company or set of companies or, oh, a new law is coming in insurance. How is that going to affect everybody? Maybe I could grab an expert and find out. Looking at things that are going to happen in 6 months. You know, becoming an idea generator is a big part of this job. So yeah, I do have a process for generating ideas, and I do read industry sites very widely. When I was writing on franchising for Forbes, I was reading all the franchising trades, Nation's Restaurant News, Quick Serve Restaurant, Fast Casual Magazine, And a lot of times I would pick up their data and just respin it for the Forbes audience. Lori says, I feel like I still need more specifics on writing pitches. Do you have resources or support for this? Yeah, tons of it. We run a pitch clinic class. We have a ton of resources in Freelance Writer's Den, Lori, and you can post a pitch for review by an editor, by a publications editor in the den, and you can also read through the hundreds of other pitches that we have helped make better, which is like a class in itself. And Linda, you wanted to answer also on that?
Yes, I actually wanted to answer about finding insurance ideas. I wanted to add that I think we undervalue the ideas that we can come up with from the consumer point of view. A lot of times editors are looking for a different perspective and they're so immersed in what they do that it's hard for them to kind of back up and see things from somebody else's viewpoint, which is really valuable in terms of coming up with ideas. I recently had a coaching client who had a lot of experience with volunteering at zoos and animal shelters and just a lot of animal experience. And she wanted to write for the pet industry trade magazines like Pet Business and so on. And she was having trouble making that connection between what could I possibly tell these people that they don't know. But being somebody who knows a lot about animals from the volunteer or consumer side, she probably has some inkling of what is missing in the industry or what people need, or, you know, maybe ideas about spreading goodwill by helping shelters. And the idea we came up with for her was to go to PetSmart and all the other pet stores in the area and just start chatting people up who work there. You know, what's new? What's a hot trend? What is nobody talking about? What do you wish was out there that's not out there? And so on. And in that way, you can bring a lot of value that somebody who works for a pet product manufacturing company just can't bring.
Yeah, I'm just busy looking up a post for somebody here. I'm giving you a link to a post that's an example of a string gathering story where I saw a press release about a restaurant that only served grilled cheese sandwiches. And I was like, well, that's different. And I threw it in my link file. And then I found another one. And I found another one. And I found another one. And then eventually I was like, I can do a trend story on this. And then I contacted all of those places and said, hey, what are your expansion plans? And, you know, what can you tell me about sales? And turned it into a story that, you know, 11,000 people read. And I do tons of that. I do tons of data-based stories. So many writers fear data that there's usually a lot of opportunity within research releases. And, you know, they'll send out a press release that says one big piece of news about that, you know, they've decided the big story out of their data is X. But I go looking through the data and find other stories that are in the data. To give you an example, every year one of those restaurant trades does a, you know, the biggest fast food chains in America list. And in their data breakout, they also listed how many international units they each had. And so I wrote a story about who the biggest U.S. brands were abroad, who had the most international presence of the big American chains. Same data, different angle, different story. That's, you can do that kind of stuff all day long with data. You can spin it forward. You can ask what'll happen next in this trend. You can revisit it a year after it happened. So many ways to develop angles. So I feel like another question was in there. And Lori says she's going to join us for ghostwriting. Yeah, that class is going to be amazing. And you get a one-on-one with Claudia, if you didn't know, everyone who takes the class. Lori, I'm not sure what else we should tell you about writing. Oh, I know. I think I have a post on like why your query letter, you know, didn't get an assignment. Let me see if I can get you that. It's got some of the, it's got some of the most common query errors that you just see all the time. I think, and yeah. And the number one reason that queries get rejected and ideas get rejected is because they don't have a strong news hook. And that's something we talk a lot about in Pitch Clinic. But there isn't a reason why the story has to run now. It's more like, I think this is a sort of interesting thing, don't you? Rather than next month, the state legislature will consider whether to strengthen our drunk driving laws. And I'm going to write a write a article about the state of our current drunk driving laws and the impact, the loss of life that we've experienced from repeat drunk drivers. So it comes out right ahead of that. That's actually a story I did for Seattle Magazine with that timing. I go back to when I used to have a physical futures file, which is an 80, which is a big accordion file with the numbers 1 through 31 on it. And so when you see a month from now, this is going to happen, you throw it in the 20th of the month so that you take it out and you're like, oh yeah, this is coming at the end of the month and now I should pitch this and see if I can do this. So you have to start thinking about that. Brigitte, I don't believe that we're transcribing this call. I don't think transcripts are happening in this write big session, but that is a thing we do for all our den stuff. But I can grab this chat log with the links and post that as well. So the links can get in that way. I don't know. We're about at the top of the hour. Final Jeopardy, final questions. Other things we can do to help you feel confident. What I would want to say in closing is just like, hey, this stuff is all learnable. The format of a letter of introduction, the format of a query that gets an assignment. This is just stuff you can learn. It's a sort of, each of those are a sort of a specialized skill that it seems like not a lot of people teach you, but you can totally learn to do this and improve at it. And the way you do that is by sending out a lot of them and seeing what kind of responses and feedback you get and, improving. It's really kind of just that simple. If you think that, Linda and I have not sent out queries that either were laughably bad or didn't get a response, you would really be wrong there. And even now, I mean, I've pitched ARP in recent history and not gotten a response because, like, they're the most pitched magazine in America. I wasn't emotionally crushed by the fact that I did not get into ARP with that pitch. And that is the crux of this class, is that you have to develop an inner belief that you have something valuable to give the marketplace, that writing is your superpower, and that you're just going to keep going and be an unstoppable force of nature until you find your place in the marketplace. That's the attitude that builds freelance writing careers. Not, oh my God, I didn't hear back and it's been a week and now I'm emotionally imploding because I think that means I'm terrible. And you just cannot play those kind of head games with yourself. And remember, that's you doing that to yourself. The editor has done nothing except not gotten to a chance to read your pitch yet. You have to understand that not everyone on earth can write well. Everybody can write something, but the vast majority of human beings cannot do what we do. They cannot go out, report a story, or write a sales page for a business that gets them tens of thousands of dollars of new business. It really takes, it's not about, I can write a sentence. Freelance writers are command the English language. We make words jump up and dance, and not that many people can do that. So you have to just have a belief that, you've got that. That is your thing, And you're just going to keep going. So Brigitte said, when a client seems interested and they ask for rates, and I reply that I will need project details first and I'll get back to them. Or should I know my rates? No. Yeah. Well, anytime the first question from a prospect is, what are your rates? You're talking to a bad client. They're not your client. I mean, maybe you're going to write for them, but they're not a good client because their primary concern is rates. Good clients, their primary concern is getting the right writer. And they understand that what we do is going to be hugely valuable to their business, could leverage them tons of money, and or, you know, drive a lot of circulation for their publication, keep their readers engaged, and they pay well. And they pay, in the case of publications, they often pay pretty much what they pay. Though I'm increasingly hearing creepy stories of magazines saying, so what do you want to get paid for this? And make it, throwing it back on you and making you kind of try to figure it out. So I hate that. But in general, when you tell me, you know, when a client seems interested and asks for rates, that's usually because you responded to an online job ad. And mass online job ads are a real, you know, a real suckhole of people who think of writers as a commodity and are just looking for the lowest provider, and they don't even care if you write English really competently because they're just sort of stuffing some SEO keywords on a web page, and they're just not good clients, especially not for anyone living in any developed nation with an expensive standard of living. So if you're getting that a lot, you know, hi, what's your rates? You want to look at how you are prospecting, because you probably need to swim in a different pool of prospects. And but that is how I reply, Brigitte. I'm like, I don't have a rate card up my sleeve. I'm not going to just give you a, you know, just don't ever quote rates in a vacuum without any information about the gig, the deadlines, how many people you'll need to interview, the length, their payment terms. There's a lot I need to know before I know what I would want to charge this client. And I partly want them to talk me through it more so I can get a sense of how much of a complete butt pain they're going to be to deal with, because that figures into how much I'm going to pay, want to be paid as well. Linda, I don't know if you have any other thoughts on that. Sorry to go off on a major rant about all that.
No, that was actually really hilarious about the major butt pain. I totally get that. I was actually, strangely, I don't do a lot of client work these days, but I got a text the other day from somebody who wants me to write her website, and we had a half-hour conversation today, really for me to figure out if I wanted to work with her. But I also wanted to mention in terms of rates is that, like Carol said, you cannot give a project rate until you know exactly what is expected, and then you go and you multiply how long you think it's going to take by the hourly rate you want to get, and you pad it a little bit just in case, and then you can come back to them with a project rate. But I would never have a rate card that says brochures are this much and sales letters are this much and articles are this much, because it doesn't allow you to adjust based on the size of the project, the pain in the buttness of the client, and so on. So if you do have a rate card or something on your website, I always recommend a range, because I think we talked about this last time, but a lot of people don't recommend putting your prices up on your website, but it's a really good way to scare away people who in no way can afford you. Like those people Carol was talking about, where their first question is, what are your rates? They'll see a good range that of what you charge for various projects, and they will head off to somebody cheaper.
Yeah, it's true. If I hear from people who are just getting a lot of their time wasted with a lot of bottom feeders, putting some kind of floor for rates on your site can help you not waste time that way. You know, back when I did used to respond to online job ads and they'd be like, what's your rates? I would usually say they range from, you know, 30 cents to a buck a word, or $7,500 an hour, you know, it just really depends. And, you know, I was basically just trying to get rid of them actively. Just like if this range doesn't, if you don't have a comfort zone with that kind of range, we're not going to work together, you know, so let's just find out right away. And I recommend that to everyone, really. Don't take hours and hours of meetings with clients where you're getting all excited about the relationship and stuff, and then you find out they want to pay you, you know, $15 a post, and by then you feel sort of married to the project. You want to get within 15, 20 minutes to a rate conversation. After you've gathered your info, you know, 30 minutes, I'm like, so what do you, what were you thinking about as far as budget for the, I get that you want X, Y, and Z done. And, you know, what are you thinking about in terms of your budget for getting that accomplished? And see if they'll just tell you, you know, we're used to paying this much a post or whatever. Because a lot of times they will. And or they'll say, I don't know, we've never done this before, you know, and it's back on you, or they just won't be willing to tell you. But I'm putting in a link to also my best query letter ever, which I got $6,000 in assignments off of. And that does have the actual complete pitch in it. So you can see exactly what I sent her. And so that may help you as well. And I sent a link to the tag of all of my posts about query letters. So you can kind of thumb through and enjoy that. What else can we answer for you? We're kind of over our normal amount of time, but if people still have questions, I'm happy to take them. Otherwise, we will wrap it up. And obviously, we can take more questions over on the Facebook, I think, you know, through the day. Heidi, the Facebook group isn't going away. You can all feel free to continue getting support and accountability from each other on there. Linda and I are wrapping it up today, but you know, I totally recommend staying in touch with each other and, you know, find an accountability buddy on there. That's a big thing we do in Freelance Writer's Den that seems to really help people actually do their marketing instead of just talking about it when, you know, you've made an appointment to call another writer once a week and say, okay, did you do that? It's amazing how that will compel action. Hey, Heidi, it's been great getting to know all of you in this Write Big forum. And yeah, definitely hope to see folks around in the den or maybe in Pitch Clinic or one of our other classes in the future. Linda, you have any parting thoughts?
No, I just want to say thank you. That was a really fun class. I really liked the Facebook format. It was really fun. I enjoyed answering questions on there and seeing how people were doing with their challenges. It was really impressive and fun.
Yeah, I liked it too. Great questions, everyone. And, you know, keep asking questions and reaching out and finding resources and just solving problems and not being like, oh, well, now I guess I can't do this because of X obstacle I've encountered. You have to just keep going and figuring it out. And luckily, you know, you're doing this in the era where there is online coaching like this available. You know, when Linda and I started, there was nobody. Lisa, if you're a Den member, you will stay on my Den waiting list. Or if you're on the Den waiting list, you'll stay on there unless you unsubscribe from it. You'll be there. And we will reopen the Den for regular members, but, you know, sometime later this spring. No time real soon. All right. Brigitte says, I'm ready to continue my writing. Awesome. All right. We'll see you all back on the Facebook maybe later this afternoon. And
thank you.
Keep on supporting each other.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.